Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check, testing, 1, 2, 3. Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.
Welcome back to the Quick Restart podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always by Quint Kesnick. And Quint, for as epic as last week was, this is the penultimate weekend of the regular season. Lots going on, lots to discuss, but ultimately felt like one of those situations in which things came into clearer view. Not a ton of drama is how I would characterize this week in the regular season. You called Penn State's 20-9 victory over Johns Hopkins. You're currently en route home after that assignment. And I wanted to start there because this dominating performance at home against a team that prior to last season, the Nittany Lions had kind of regarded as a little bit of a bugaboo. I thought Patty Cotter, our correspondent, who was writing up the game for us, put it well. Felt like a day at the office for the Nittany Lions. And by extension, kind of feels like maybe a page has been turned in terms of the program. These Nittany Lions are so good, and the question that I have is, are they good enough to win a national championship in your view?
I think so now, because the game today featured some subtleties and nuances in the way Penn State was forced to attack. Okay, Hopkins had a clear game plan. They're not going to slide. Penn State's been a great passing team, and Hopkins felt that if they started sliding to Ament and other middies, that it would be death by a thousand wounds. And the great passing offense, it's generating this, you know, gaudy 43% shooting. So Hopkins tried to maintain their matchups and not slide, and guess what? They couldn't hold those matchups, and Penn State scored all sorts of unassisted goals, whether it was Grant Ament winning his matchup or Jack Kelly or Dylan Folds or Nick Spillane. The dodging and shooting of Penn State's ball handlers proved to be strong, and I like their defense. I thought they, again, held their matchups well. They timed their double teams. Only question marks going forward out of this game may be in the faceoff department and some wing play there. They scored two faceoff goals, but Hopkins at one time in the game started to, you know, chip into the Penn State lead by winning some draws. But otherwise, a complete performance, really impressed, great crowd. And any kind of questions about Penn State's, you know, trajectory were answered. This is a team that's got to be unanimous number one this week and sets them up for the Big Ten tournament. They play Rutgers, but sets them up for the Big Ten tournament and then a run at a number one overall seed.
You posed on social media leading up to this game, is Penn State's offense playing at historic levels? Concurrent with that, I had a conversation with someone who asked me, is there a top five offensively better than Virginia's? And the question asker quickly, you know, kind of amended himself, and he was like, oh yeah, of course, Penn State. And I pushed back on it. I'm like, no, I'm not certain about that. I mean, I definitely think that Ament and O'Keefe are, you know, above the level that Virginia's top two offensive players, regardless of who you identify them to be, say, you know, Krause and Aiken. But then 3, 4, 5, you know, I don't know if
6, 7, 8, 9.
That was the point
close
that I made.
It's not even close, Terry. Anyone who makes that argument is not looking at tape and not looking at the numbers.
Well, no. Hold on. You just jumped all over my point. So, like, I might take Virginia's 3, 4, 5, but Penn State 6, 7, 8, 9, potentially even 10 and 11 is far above anybody else in the country. And it's interesting because number one coming into the season, I didn't see that coming. And number two, that to me is so important in terms of NCAA. What's the right word? Like ability to withstand adversity, because you can turn to multiple places if you have a matchup issue, because you can get that out of the, not kind of out of nowhere performance, you know, the Colin Briggs 4 goals in Championship Monday type performance, because there's so many different available options. How much do you regard that as being key and instrumental to this team's success in the future?
I think it's essential, as I said, because, you know, they've been attacking in a mode where teams have been sliding like crazy, and their passing game has been spectacular. Okay, generating layups and dunks, and O'Keefe has been the beneficiary of that, you know, finding time and room with good angles. Today, the game changed for them because Hopkins was refusing to slide. It became a dodging game, and I had question marks coming in. I didn't know whether these midfielders were legit and could earn their own shots and earn quality shots consistently. And they did that. And then next thing you know, it was just different numbers contributing. As I said, you know, Kelly, Folds, and Spillane. O'Keefe was a little quiet today. And so that's a huge, huge plus for Penn State, not reliant on two guys. It's more than just a 1-2 show. They scored in transition. And as I said, you know, guys kept coming off the bench and contributing. They've got, you know, multiple 20 goal scorers. They're spacing, whether they're attacking from X, GLE, high wing, or top center. You know, there's a versatility in the way they're attacking goal in the 6-on-6 that right now looks like it's impossible.
So let's go ahead and hear from sophomore midfielder Jack Kelly, who was with the press post game on Sunday.
Last year, you guys beat Johns Hopkins, and it's, you know, first time in program history. It's huge, huge, huge deal. And today, it just looked like you guys, another day at the office.
Yeah, so what we talked about yesterday was that we need to make it a regular thing to beat Johns Hopkins, not kind of engrave it in our tradition to beat them, as they obviously have, like, a huge history of lacrosse. You know, we want to kind of change the script on that, and it should be us winning all the time.
Yeah, you guys were cruised today.
Yeah, I mean, we had a good week of preparation, so we get ready. We have a lot of guys that get us all kind of fired up to play, and so we come out hot.
Do you think the number one ranking is getting to you guys at all, or are you just...
Are we ranked number one?
Gotcha. Jack, I mean, you missed 2 weeks, and you come back and have a career day. Just what went into that?
Yeah, I mean, I got great teammates playing with me and supporting me the whole way, so... I just kind of got some opportunities today and took advantage of them.
And then what was it like just missing those games, like, again, two quality opponents?
Yeah, no, missing's no fun, but we have a lot of guys who can step up in any position, so that's a lot of fun to watch.
You got a hat trick against Maryland the last time that you were out in the field. Do you feel like you picked up right where you left off today?
Yeah, definitely felt good, but again, like, I got a lot of teammates giving me opportunities to do well.
I feel like this is the most complete effort that you guys have had this season.
I mean, we've had a lot of complete efforts, and that was definitely a good one. So, I mean, we can always get better and tighten up certain things. But yeah, it was definitely a great effort from us.
Coming down the stretch of the season, what is a win like this where you're in control more or less from beginning to end?
Right. So I guess that would be good for us in terms of, like, wear and tear on guys. So we get to get a lot more people in. So that's a lot of fun to see. We had a Seamus Flynn score a goal late, and that's a lot of fun to watch. So and kind of finishing the game a little earlier is good for wear and tear.
It seems like the offense is getting more comfortable to try maybe more behind the back passes, more fancy stuff.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
So we're always told just have fun, and we have a lot of really good instinctual players, and so we kind of have a green light to try those things and kind of just trust our instincts and do kind of what's best with what we think.
Is that green light new, or is it something you guys always have?
It's not new, but we kind of figure it as we keep rolling and just trying things, and I don't know, it just comes along with time.
So I want to open up this conversation to include Johns Hopkins, but in so doing, it's helpful to shine a spotlight on the Ohio State-Maryland game that took place on Saturday. So we'll transition into Saturday's action and start in Columbus, where Maryland built a, you know, kind of consistent 2-ish, 3-ish goal lead throughout much of the first half. Ohio State made a run in the third quarter, Maryland answered, but then trailing 8-6 with about 6 minutes left in the fourth quarter, Ohio State got a nice dunk from Trey LeClair, and then an unreal Jack Jasinski goal with the shot clock expiring, in which it looked like he almost banked his shot in off of the Maryland goaltender, and then they took the lead off of a face-off violation, subsequent face-off, and then the extra man. Ohio State's extra man has not been good this year, and yet Jack Myers found Jackson Reed in the middle of the defense for an easy turn and finish. Ohio State goes up 9-8 with about 4 minutes left, and then with 23 seconds to go, Logan Wisnoskis answers. It's tied 9-9. The Maryland Terrapins win the opening faceoff to overtime off of a Justin Inácio faceoff violation, and 30 seconds later, Jared Bernhardt ended it 10-9. Maryland, in my opinion, secures their stranglehold on the number two ranking in the Inside the Cross media poll. They put themselves in really good position to grab the two seed in the Big Ten tournament, and they cast Ohio State's Big Ten tournament hopes into doubt. That being said, in order for the Buckeyes' clearest path into the tournament is for Rutgers to beat Penn State. And it's hard to imagine, but, you know, if there's a scenario in which Penn State rests their starters or something like that, et cetera, and then they need Maryland to beat Johns Hopkins. In that scenario, Rutgers is the three seed. Johns Hopkins and Ohio State are tied with two wins, presuming that Ohio State beats Maryland. That was a very important part that I left out. And Ohio State holds the tiebreaker over the Blue Jays. So in that scenario, obviously the Blue Jays take care of business against Maryland, and it's all moot. What's your assessment of how this shakes out, knowing that probably the likeliest outcome is we get three teams tied at 2-3, and then we go to the second tiebreaker?
Well, I'm hearing that there's some confusion about the tiebreakers, and I'm not quite honestly sure what it is right now because,
sure,
you know, the goal differential, I heard maybe capped off at 3. So you don't get credit for winning a game by 8 goals. That gets shrunk into 3, perhaps. But we're still waiting for the Big Ten office to give us clarity on how that goal differential works in that first tiebreaker, if there are, in fact, 3 teams tied at 2-3. So this is important stuff that we need to get from the league office as soon as possible. As far as Maryland's, I love their second half against Rutgers. This game, again, they played in spots offensively. The defense was good, though. Anytime you hold a team now to single digits in this day and age with the shot clock, it's an outstanding performance. You know, Bernhardt can't get enough touches in my eyes. You know, when he handles, good things happen. And Maryland got some production from the bench, which is bodes well for them. That too often this year they've been relying on Wisnowskis and Bernhardt and Bubba Fairman and not enough guys coming off the bench. But they got some goals from complimentary guys, which is critical.
So what's your assessment of the Blue Jays? Do you think that they can beat Maryland in College Park with their season potentially on the line?
No.
What is the recipe for improvement for this Blue Jay team?
It's midfield. You know, they don't have top 10 quality midfielders. They don't have top 10 quality defensive midfielders. I think their attack is good. I think their defense is veteran, but they've made too many mistakes this year. I think their goaltending is below par, and I think their faceoff game has been a little erratic. For the most part, it's been a positive, though, this year after the Towson debacle. You know, there's a lot. I see a team that just couldn't stand up to winning matchups against quality athletic teams in the middle of the field. Turnovers today at you know, poor turnovers, you know, unforced turnovers, middle of the field turnovers, turnovers late in quarters. That was costly.
Moving on from the Big Ten, the ACC tournament field is set. That result dictated primarily or exclusively by Notre Dame's 12-10 win over North Carolina. Elsewhere in league action, Syracuse beat Navy 18-9. Virginia beat Marist 22-6, and in the first game of the day, the Duke Blue Devils survived an OT scare versus Marquette. They won 10-9. That game was played at a neutral site on Long Island. You know, for me, an improved performance from Notre Dame, but they continued to zig and zag. They have not, as you have and I have discussed, won or lost consecutive games dating back to early March. So it's a function of, you know, play well one week, play poorly the next week. And in this one, they got a victory that allows them to avoid that first round quarterfinal, I guess you would call it, 4-5 matchup. That'll be played between Syracuse and North Carolina on Thursday night. And then the semifinals will be played on Saturday, and I assume you're doing those games?
We're not doing the 4-5 game on Thursday, right, but ESPNU will cover the ACC semis from the Carolina new facility, 2:00 and 4:30 on ESPNU. You know, Notre Dame, Brennan Gleeson had the big day with 5 goals, wearing that number 40 jersey as a tribute to Mike Sennett, former Notre Dame captain in the early 90s who went on to coach in the St. Louis area. And was real, he was a real pioneer in that area, not only winning state titles for the team he coached, but also producing dozens and dozens of former players who then have grown the game in the state of Missouri. So it was a magical number when it was worn by Sergio Perkovic a couple years ago, and that trend continues. The question now is, does Gleason stay with number 40 in this ACC tournament and beyond? Big win from Notre Dame. They got it done.
Before you move on from that, I don't think you know this. My brother was his assistant coach and was really with him on the road trip when he had his failed heart attack.
At Jesuit?
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I actually went to, when I was playing in high school, I went and practiced with this Met a couple times and got to experience how Steel, which was his nickname, what his approach was. Man, that was a well-earned nickname. That guy's jaw was made out of pure steel. And yes, he is certainly a godfather to St. Louis lacrosse.
Yeah, so that was good to see. And Notre Dame now, you know, they're always a dangerous team with the way they can play defense, and they do have offensive talent. The interesting thing about the ACC tournament, obviously there's no AQ. And Syracuse, who's the hottest team in the league, has to now play the five team. And that's, you know, dangerous territory. But how about Cuse, Terry? I mean, from day one until now, you could argue they're the most improved team in the country. The last three or four games have been brilliant. Sharing the ball on offense, getting production from the attack, depth of scoring at the midfield, just a nasty defense with Kennedy and Mellon. I love Drake Porter, the way he handles the ball, a face-off game that's been pretty good. And I give Coach Desko and this group a lot of credit because they're clearly trending in the right direction. You know, I think that they're a team to be reckoned with now as we go forward.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a couple conversations this week about Syracuse as well, and it's something that, because it's 2019, it feels like it's crystallized for me. One of the things that I think their fans have such a problem with is that we're now 10 years into this program's identity has changed from what it was in the preceding 25 years that their fan base was so in love with, which was a swashbuckling, talent-oriented team. This is a program that is now built on player development and playing a very fundamental style. They get better over the course of the season with, you know, pretty consistent regularity. You talked about how much improved they are, and I think that's true. But consider the fact that they don't have a guy who scored more than 40 points. They've played 12 games. It's not as if, you know, this is early in the season. So, you know, they're really well distributed in terms of the balance of their scoring. They win at both ends of the field. They play a ton of guys. It really feels like, to me, this coaching staff doesn't get the credit that they deserve for how much they've adjusted their approach based on what the program was in the 80s, 90s, and even into the 2000s. And I think that, you know, it's a Syracuse team that is built for the modern game. It's just a very hard thing for longtime Syracuse fans to fully wrap their arms around.
There's no number 22 at Cuse right now. I will tell you, Stephen Rafis's improvement, and he took a lot of heat in the early season. He had a severe flu. He had some other injuries, and he wasn't himself in those first 3 to 5 games. But now as he's turned the corner, all of a sudden that attack is perked up dramatically. Bradley Voigt's had a strong season as an inside finisher. I think the roles are defined, and they're sharing the ball at a level right now that they haven't in you know, the prior, let's say, you know, first part of the season. So, dangerous team with a great defense, and it'll be really interesting to see how they handle this Thursday game with North Carolina, who's playing basically elimination lacrosse, and then if they can bounce back and beat the number one seed Virginia, a game that I covered in the Dome, a game the Syracuse probably should have won, and Virginia had a miraculous comeback in that game. That'll be a fascinating ACC semi.
Turning our attention to the Ivy League, the Penn Quakers clinched an outright title for the first time since 1986 with a 22-6 victory over Dartmouth. Hard to take a lot away from that one, but when you look at what this team has done, with the exception of their 17-7 loss to Duke, they've put up at least 12 goals in every game, and they've topped 20 in their last two with a 26-13 win over Harvard. The Cornell Big Red scored an important 12-9 victory over Brown, and Princeton beat Harvard 19-15. Yale played an out-of-league game on Friday night, and TD Erlin was near perfect in a 10-5 victory over Albany at KC Stadium. So this one, in a lot of ways, I think comes down to Cornell versus Princeton, and we'll see how that shakes out, and it's going to determine the factor of whether or not Brown can remain involved in this bid for an Ivy League tournament. They play Dartmouth in their regular season finale.
I was up at Franklin Field on Wednesday, and I got to watch about 20 minutes of Penn's practice. They're much more athletic than you would guess. And you know, they've gotten a lot of public notoriety, so to speak, on their three losses, okay? And that's always dangerous, to give team credit for losses to anybody. Their losses happen to be to the top teams in the country. Now, who have they beaten? Well, they beat Nova, handled that game. They could have won by a wider margin. They gave up four-man down goals. They beat Cornell by one, okay? Penn wasn't great in that game. They had seven failed clears. They didn't do well in the ground ball games outside of faceoffs. And then Yale, they beat them in three OTs. Remember in that game, Yale took like 66 shots. I think Yale may have taken 10 in the overtime period, but I'm not quite positive. Reed Junkin was the hero with 22 saves. So what do we know about Penn? I'm going to watch more tape over the next couple of weeks, getting ready for the Ivy tournament. They're legit and can put anybody. That's without a doubt. But can they beat quality teams? Now, you know, to win a national title, you got to beat four. To make championship weekend, you got to get two. For them to make the Ivy finals or win an Ivy League championships is going to be challenging. Can they do that the second time? You know, can they beat Yale again? If they face Cornell, can they beat Cornell again? This is a team, I go back to 2014. You remember it well. They were a four seed in the NCAA tournament, and they lost that home game to Drexel. Okay, that stands out. Now, that's no indication or representation about what that current roster, who this current team is. But that hangs over them. And in my eyes, we put a little too much importance on history. But just be careful, because I think Penn belongs in the top 10. I think you could have them as high as 3 or 4. I think you could have them as low as 8 or 9. And I think we will learn a lot in the Ivy League tournament. Yeah, they're legit, but do it again when adjustments are made from the regular season game.
A team that you and I have spoken about at length multiple times on this podcast, I think is worth revisiting again, because the Loyola Greyhounds looked okay in a midweek win over Georgetown, looked really bad in a road loss at Boston University, and then fell behind 3-0 to Army before turning it around and putting up a 13-9 victory in West Point. That's a really meaningful result for a variety of reasons, including the fact that the Greyhounds are in the driver's seat to once again host the Patriot League tournament. Pat Spencer had 7 points in that game. He remains on pace to, if they make it to the semifinals, be within spitting distance of Lyle Thompson's all-time scoring record. But the defensive game plan early for the Black Knights was really interesting, and they were very effective at limiting Kevin Lindley and Aiden Olmstead off ball. They really turned Spencer into a goal scorer, and it wasn't until Chase Scanlon got unlocked a little bit in the second quarter that the Greyhounds were able to find an answer, and then they were able to pull away in a key early fourth quarter stretch. So for me, when you couple that result with Bucknell's win over Lehigh, it, you know, basically returns this conference to form, in the sense that the Greyhounds, in my opinion, remain favorites, particularly given all the advantages that come with being the one seed, avoiding that quarterfinal game, hosting the Friday-Sunday action. I presume, actually, it's still Friday-Sunday. I don't know that for certain, because they did change the week. It's now the last week in the season, as opposed to the second to last, as it had been for a really long time. And then there's a logjam right below there in terms of the presumptive 2, 3, and 4 seeds: Boston University, Lehigh, and Army, all with 5 wins.
Yeah, Loyola finishes up at Lafayette on Friday night. Okay, so they're gonna host this Patriot League tournament. Their women's team is also hosting the tournament, by the way. And so I'm not sure how that impacts scheduling, field availability. Bailey Savio had a great game. You know, most teams face off strong against Army. Loyola, maybe the turnovers and the failed clears, something to be considered. And I think, this is off the top of my head, Terry, I think Loyola's undefeated this year with a full week to prepare for their games.
Ooh, interesting. It's a good tidbit.
Because they lost to Duke on a Thursday night.
Yep. They lost to Towson midweek. They lost to Boston U after they played Georgetown. So, yes.
Yeah, with a full week to prepare, Loyola's undefeated this year. I don't know if that's impact, you know, shows you what Charlie Toomey and the staff and Coach Van Arsdale do, or whether that's more of a in relationship to Spencer's health and or depth at midfield or whatever. But they play their best when they have a full practice week.
So moving around the rest of the landscape, I think one of the most significant results was Hobart's victory over Mount St. Mary. Coming in, the Mount seemed to be the team to beat in the NEC. Now I think the pendulum switches back to the Statesmen. St. Joe's, with a win over Wagner, remains in good contention for that fourth seed. Sacred Heart and Robert Morris also have three wins. St. Joe's, excuse me, has losses to both. So I take it back. They need to beat the Mount at the Mount on Saturday in order to be in the NEC tournament.
Some of these leagues are highly up for grabs. Multiple teams going for bids. Tiebreakers are going to be needed, whether it's the MAC. You know, SoCon, we got High Point going to play Richmond, which is just a critical game. Big East is a logjam as well, so stay with InsideLacrosse.com this week for tiebreaker scenarios, for schedules, and to really understand the importance of each of the games that are being played. As I say so often, you know, the tournament's only 17 teams, but like this week, there are probably 40 or 50 teams still playing for life in the postseason.
And that's a good tipping off point to what I wrote about for Sunday morning, which is Utah hosted Cleveland State on Saturday. The Vikings went out, got a one-sided victory, got themselves to 500. They have their season finale Wednesday at home against Detroit Mercy, a team against which I believe they got their program's first victory in an end-of-season matchup 2 years ago. Meanwhile, the Utes, you know, they were, I believe, 4-2 or 4-3 at one point, have since hit a skid, certainly highlighted by leads that were relinquished against Hartford and Mount St. Mary. That being said, two very competitive teams that don't have a conference given their stage of development. And I think that the sport of lacrosse needs to take responsibility for finding a solution to that. There are so many examples of coaches talking about how the advent of an automatic qualifier for the NCAA tournament and the ability to play for that AQ via a league tournament redefined or evolved their program in terms of what it particularly does is it removes the possibility of your season effectively being over in early March, which was the case for some of these leagues. If you played and had two league losses by St. Patrick's Day, there wasn't a whole lot that you could play for from that point on. And I think that the AQ has done so much to keep teams alive into mid-April, and that is so pivotal for program development, because even if you don't meet your goals this year, the extra quality practice from top of the bench to the bottom in terms of guys buying in because they have something to play for has dividends years down the road. And I think that for so many reasons, Utah and Cleveland State deserve to find a conference home, and their coaches have done a really nice job, having been dealt a tough hand, not being able to play for a spot in the NCAA tournament, the ultimate payoff for so many college lacrosse players. And I really hope that that's something that gets resolved this summer. And there's a lot of different available opportunities or available options, and it's a function of a couple of coaches, a couple of athletic administrators, perhaps a conference official or two, recognizing, all right, if we sacrifice a little bit here and find a way to, you know, get something out of it on the back end, we're doing something for the good of the sport that we should be doing.
What are we at? 73 Division I teams right now. The women's game, meanwhile, has 115, where their tournament, I think, is 27 deep. They got like 15 AQs and about a dozen at-large selections with two playing games, I think. You know, again, that's based on the formula the NCAA uses. So we can't open up the tournament. we got to find conferences for Cleveland State or Utah, or add more teams and have more independents so that we could, you know, maybe pick someone from that independent pool ultimately, because the Pac-12 is years away from happening, and there are a few whispers of additions of D1 teams for next year.
Well, Quint, happy Easter to those who celebrate. Any parting words of wisdom as you get ready to get back on the road?
Well, Chris Gray and James Burr, now the highest scoring duo in the country. They have 154 points in a year where there's some quality duos, Beccaro and Caraway from Georgetown, the O'Keefe-Ament combination that we saw on Sunday afternoon. Denver making the goalie switch to Cole French last week, but I also saw Alex Reddy got some playing time this weekend, so that's still up in the air. You know, what's going to happen in the Big East? I think that's a really crazy conference, because it's looking like a one big league between Georgetown, Nova, and Denver. Bid Steelers. Where are the Bid Steelers this year? And as I mentioned, High Point plays Richmond on Saturday, a huge game in that league. UMass continuing to get it done. They and Towson seem to be the premier teams in their conference.
Yeah, so with Towson's win over Delaware, UMass hosting Delaware in the regular season finale, if they take care of business there by virtue of the Minutemen's win over the Tigers last week, they will be the one seed and host the CAA tournament.
Keep it simple. Thank you for that info, Terry.
All right, Quint, that'll do it for this edition of the Quick Restart Podcast. As always, thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, tell a friend. Leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen to us. Hit us up on Twitter at @inside_lacrosse. I'm at Terrence Foy. He's at Q Kesnick. Make sure to check out the In the Crease podcast on Tuesday, and we'll be back next week. Next week, Quint, will be the last Quick Restart of the regular season. We'll have Selection Sunday to react to next time we talk after that.
Crazy to think that we're almost at the end of the road here. There's still tons of lacrosse to be played and the good games and things big build and get bigger and bigger and bigger, and the stakes grow. And on the road to Philadelphia, there's certainly going to be some crazy things between here and Memorial Day.
The tulips have popped.
My tulips are looking good, Terry. Now comes the wind and the rain and the storms, and they'll be gone in a week, and we move on to what's next.
Poke check, rap check, back check, slap check, testing 1, 2, 3, poke check, rap check, back check, slap check.
Welcome to the Quick Restart. We cover 73 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
And we do it fast.